Hey everyone, this is Tiana, your host of the True Crime Podcast, Truth Seeker. As this episode contains graphic and disturbing content, it may not be suitable for all audiences. Listener discretion is advised. Most 11-year-olds still believe in Santa Claus, the Easter Bunny, magic, and hold the innocence of simply being ignorant to the crazy world around them. Think back to when you were that age, your worries or lack thereof. Probably more concerned about playing with your friends or planning your birthday party or thinking about what you wanted for Christmas. You definitely weren't thinking you'd be sitting in jail waiting to find out if you'd be tried as an adult for murder. The morning of February 20th, 2009 probably started out normal for 11-year-old Jordan Brown, waking up to get ready for a day of fifth grade in school. However, he would be picked up from school early by Pennsylvania State Police and end up being questioned twice, as sometime in the morning hour, someone shot and killed his 26-year-old and 8.5-month pregnant stepmom, Kinsey Houck, and the unborn baby. And by the early morning hours of February 21st, police would arrest 11-year-old Jordan Brown, believing it was he that killed her. Jordan Brown was born on August 30th, 1997, in New Beaver, Pennsylvania, a small town in western Pennsylvania, about 40 miles west of Pittsburgh. Jordan was raised by his father, Chris Brown, in the same little town he was born. Being the only child and raised solely by Chris, Jordan was Chris's world. They did everything together. In my research, I could find no record or mention of Jordan's biological mother anywhere. According to interviews by Chris, Jordan was a typical 11-year-old boy. He played sports, baseball, and was quarterback of his peewee football team. The football team was called the Warriors and was coached by Chris. Chris was engaged to Kinsey, someone that Chris had known for many, many years. Kinsey, also a single mother having two young girls, worked as a hairstylist and as a stay-at-home mom. Kinsey's daughters were 7 and 4 years old at the time she died. According to Kinsey's mother, Debbie, in a 2020 interview, Kinsey was feisty, funny, always had a beautiful smile, and liked everybody and loved children. Her sister Jennifer stated that all she would ever say when someone asked Kinsey what she wanted to be when she grew up was that she wanted to be a mom. Shortly before her death, Kinsey, her daughters, Chris, and Jordan moved in together, and everything seemed to be going well according to Chris, with Jordan even beginning to call Kinsey mom. Jordan viewed the relationship as good, strong even, stating he liked her a lot. And there was a new baby on the way. Kinsey was pregnant with Chris, and they were expecting a boy that they had planned to name Christopher. Chris and Jordan both stated that they were happy to have the new baby on the way, but her family saw things quite differently. Even though they stated she was there for Jordan and he had a good relationship with her, in an interview with the Associated Press in February 2009, Debbie Houck, Kinsey's mother, stated that Jordan used to give Kinsey a hard time, especially when Chris was not around. Debbie stated that for about 2 months that Jordan had been threatening Kinsey and that Chris was often telling Jordan not to disrespect her. It was also noted that Kinsey's brother-in-law, Jason Craner, had spoken to several reporters stating that Jordan had also told his son that he wanted to kill Kinsey and her two daughters. Jason stated that Jordan had told his son that he was going to pop Kinsey in the head and then pop both kids. Jason said he and Kinsey just never believed that Jordan was serious. In a 2020 interview, now 21-year-old Jordan recalls his childhood up to that point as being normal, with friends in school and coming by the house to play video games. But that normal childhood would come to a screeching halt the day of February 20th, 2009. Chris recalls that when he awoke that morning, he was running late, and that Kinsey asked him to stay home, but he didn't. Although he did not provide a reason in the interview, he states it's something that still haunts him. Jordan remembers that it being a normal morning, that Kinsey's 7-year-old daughter woke him to start getting ready for school. According to the report, Kinsey was asleep in the downstairs master bedroom, and Jordan and the other children were in the upstairs bedroom. The plan was that after the baby arrived, Kinsey and Chris would swap bedrooms with Jordan, so Jordan had already started to move some of his things and clothes to the downstairs bedroom. Jordan states that he went downstairs to the bedroom to grab some clothes and then went to the bathroom to get ready. He and Kinsey's 7-year-old daughter sat on the couch in the living room waiting. Kinsey then told them to go because the bus was coming and they would be late, so he and Kinsey's daughter ran out the back door, down the driveway, and went to school. According to the interview, this was about 8:15 a.m., Kinsey's 4-year-old daughter was still asleep upstairs when Jordan and her 7-year-old left for school. The report states that tree trimmers arrived at Chris and Kinsey's home around 9 a.m. to start work around the house. Sometime later, but not much later, a tree trimmer recalls seeing the 4-year-old crying in the doorway. He stops to ask her what is wrong, and that is when she tells the trimmer that her mother is dead. He stops everything he's doing immediately and calls 911. When police arrived on the scene and started their investigation, they initially assumed that Kinsey had hemorrhaged. Yet at that point, they had not moved or touched Kinsey to make that determination, as they were trying to maintain the integrity of the scene. However, it was determined that when the coroner was there and taking photographs that Kinsey had not hemorrhaged but was in fact murdered. One of the detectives of the house, Jeffrey Martin, was standing at the doorway when the coroner was photographing the scene and touched Kinsey's body, stating that there was a problem, and that is when he stated it was a homicide. Kinsey had been shot in the back of the head and what was noted to be execution style. The police did state that they did attempt CPR, but it was too late. Initially in the interview, police stated that they did not touch or move the body until the coroner arrived and photographed the scene. So there is not a timeline on how much time that took for the coroner to arrive, and note that Kinsey was shot when they attempted CPR. According to reports, after the failed CPR attempt, they called Chris to inform him that he needed to come home right away. Once he arrived, he was told that Kinsey and the baby were dead. Chris recalls that he lost it, collapsed in the yard when he was told of the horrifying news. The police state that they took Chris in and he was interviewed and voluntarily provided a statement. Police officer now retired Terry Steinheiser, when questioned during the 2020 interview, asking if he considered Chris to be a suspect, stated that when an investigation is first started, that everything is open for suspects. Chris told police during his interview about the final moments that morning he saw Kinsey alive, that he gave her a kiss, he told her he loved her, and that she kissed him back and he left. Chris also told police that he had an alibi, that he was at work at the factory. Police stated that they tested his hands for gunpowder residue, which according to police came back clean. Police eliminated Chris early on in the investigation based on his alibi, which checked out with his employer, and his GPR coming back clean. Police then went to the elementary school where Jordan and Kinsey's 7-year-old daughter attended school. Her daughter stated in the interview that she could not remember anything being out of the normal routine that morning, and Jordan also reported to police about this normal morning routine with nothing seeming off. Jordan recalls now, in a 2020 interview, that two police officers asked him if anything unusual happened, and he told them that it was just a normal morning. Jordan does add that he remembered seeing a black truck by the family house garage. He stated that he did not think anything of it, and that he thought it was just some guy there at the house doing some work. However, in a subsequent police interview, Jordan would change his version of the truck and add that there was someone in the truck with a hat on. In the early morning hours of February 21st at about 3:30 a.m., police arrived pounding at the door of the home. Chris recalls that after the stressful day and just losing his fiancée and unborn baby, that he and Jordan had only just fallen asleep when the police arrived. To the shock and awe of Chris, police have a warrant to arrest 11-year-old Jordan for the murders. According to Jordan, they took him in the back of the police cruiser to the station, and then after that took him to the county jail. All the while, Jordan is not aware of what is going on. But what is happening was that the cops believed that Jordan killed Kinsey and that it was premeditated, and that the motive was jealousy. He was jealous of the blended family dynamics, and even more jealous that Kinsey was pregnant. Pregnant with a little boy that his father was so excited about and would be named after his father. The police believe that the morning Kinsey was killed, that Jordan went back upstairs and retrieved two guns and returned downstairs. However, the older of Kinsey's daughters had seen him, so he had gone back upstairs. That is when he returned with a gun hidden under the blanket and shot Kinsey in the back of the head. This conclusion was reached by police when the daughter of Kinsey was interviewed again. In the second interview, she stated now that she remembered that Jordan was moving his guns around that morning. She also stated that before leaving for school, she heard a big boom noise, and she had thought it sounded like a gun. Jordan did own guns, as he used to hunt with his dad, and according to Kinsey's family, he was a good shot. The autopsy supported the police's suspicions when it was determined that Kinsey died by a single shotgun shot to the head. So when police did a search of the home and found a collection of handguns, rifles, and different types of ammunition, they started to believe it was not a stranger that shot Kinsey, but someone inside the house. Police then found a 20-gauge shotgun that was Jordan's. It was a youth model shotgun, and according to police, it smelled as if it had recently been fired. Kinsey's daughter also told police that her and Jordan were walking to the bus. She had noticed that he emptied something out of his pocket. According to Jordan, he was removing lint from his pocket, but police recovered a 20-gauge shotgun shell next to the home in the driveway the next day, believing that it was the shell that Jordan was disposing of when Kinsey's daughter noticed him emptying his pocket. But one thing that got me with this theory is that the police admitted they did not check Jordan's hands for gunshot residue. They did do a gunpowder residue test and found gunpowder residue on Jordan's shirts and pants. However, his attorney argued that they could have come off of his jacket, which he recently worn when he was at a turkey shoot. Forensic experts even testified on how gunshot residue can be transferred during Jordan's trial. In addition to police not testing Jordan's hands for GSR, they also did not find any blood or tissue on the gun or his clothing. One would expect both to be found if Jordan had shot Kinsey execution style that morning. If Jordan shot Kinsey, ran back upstairs, placed the gun back to where he had it, and immediately went to school, one would expect to see some sort of evidence on him or strange behavior. It had to be quick. He would have no time to clean up as they had to make it in time to catch the bus. But the bus driver and teacher stated they did not see anything unusual on or about Jordan that day. And my thought is, what 11-year-old has the mindset to do all this and leave little to no evidence behind? What 11-year-old could be that methodical in murder? But even with all the lack of physical evidence and police never even providing certainty that Jordan's gun was the murder weapon, the juvenile judge found Jordan delinquent. In juvenile court, delinquent is the equivalent of a guilty verdict in regular court. To me, the cops had tunnel vision and went right for Jordan. I'm not saying that they did not have reason to have him as a person of interest. However, police were informed of another potential suspect or person of interest early on in the investigation. This was someone brought up by Kinsey's family, not just by Chris, after Kinsey was found murdered. This was Kinsey's ex-boyfriend, Adam Harvey. Kinsey had dated Adam for about 6 years and, according to reports, was the father of Kinsey's youngest daughter, the 4-year-old. Kinsey and her family even had a protective order against Adam, as he reported to have been calling them and leaving messages threatening to kill Kinsey and her entire family. Adam also drove a black truck. And Adam also had a motive, as he told police that he recently found out that the daughter he had with Kinsey was not, in fact, his biological child at all. But police stated that they did an interview with Adam at length, and that he agreed to a polygraph, and that they tested his hands for residue. And even though Adam drove a black truck, they did not believe that he made the almost 24-hour drive to kill Kinsey and then go back to his house. This conclusion was reached because when they got to the house, there was still snow on the hood of the truck that appeared not to be recently disturbed. Adam's alibi was that he was at home asleep when Kinsey was killed, and the one to corroborate that alibi was Adam's father. With that, police cleared Adam as a suspect, all within one day. I always struggle when police come to a conclusion of any suspect so quickly, either clearing or arresting someone. Without a direct confession, how does one conclude a murder investigation in one day? In one day, they cleared one suspect, arrested an 11-year-old boy for murder. One day. So in 2018, when Jordan's delinquent ruling was adjudicated, I can't say I was surprised. I was able to come across the Pennsylvania Supreme Court ruling, and it is a bit long, but I think this gives the most detail of this case, and I'd like to go over it with you all now. The court document I was able to come across is from the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania's Western District. It was argued November 29, 2017 by Justice Todd with a decision on July 18, 2018. The court order goes on to say that J.B., a juvenile, appeals from the Superior Court's order affirming that the dispositional order of the juvenile court entered after its adjudication of J.B., delinquent, of the offenses of first-degree murder and homicide of an unborn child in connection with the shooting death of his stepmother inside their family home on the morning of February 20, 2009. J.B. asserts that there was sufficient evidence to support his adjudication of delinquency beyond a reasonable doubt for these offenses, and, alternatively, that the juvenile's court adjudication was against the weight of the evidence. Our careful review of the evidentiary record in this matter compels our conclusion that the evidence introduced at his hearing was insufficient as a matter of law to establish his delinquency for these offenses beyond a reasonable doubt. As a result, we are obligated to reverse the Superior Court order which affirmed the Juvenile's Court order of disposition of these offenses. I want to go over the factual background and the remaining of this document as well, but please keep in mind I'm not reading it verbatim, as there's a lot of information and a lot of references that I don't think I have to go into, but you can find the court document online and review it yourself. So let's get into the factual background now. The court document goes on to say that in our prior opinion in this matter regarding J.B., we recounted the factual circumstances surrounding the criminal offenses for which J.B. was adjudicated delinquent. As these facts must be scrutinized as part of our consideration of J.B.'s present claims, we set forth those facts from that opinion in full. During February 2009, C.B., an adult male, along with his fiancée, K.M.H., the victim, her two daughters, J.H., age 7, and A.H., age 4, and C.B.'s 11-year-old son, J.B., were living together in a two-story rented house. The house was located in a rural area surrounded by farmland and woods and situated near a town of Wampum, Pennsylvania. During the pre-dawn hours of the morning of Friday, February 20th, 2009, CB left the house to go to work. According to CB, it had snowed overnight, and at the time he was leaving, about 6:45 a.m., there was snow on the ground. CB recalled that he departed in his usual fashion by backing his vehicle out of a parking area adjoining the rear of the house and onto the long driveway which led from a combination storage barn and garage located behind the house to the nearby road. He arrived at work approximately 15 minutes later at around 7 a.m. Later that morning, JB came downstairs from his upstairs bedroom in the house to get dressed for school. During this time period, CB and the victim, who was then over 8 months pregnant, had been in the process of relocating the contents of their shared bedroom on the first floor of their home to JB's upstairs bedroom, attached to which was another smaller bedroom that they had previously converted into a nursery for use once the baby was born. This shared bedroom was located in the front of the house, directly to the right of the front room. In preparation for the final move, which was to take place during the upcoming weekend, some of JB's personal belongings, including his clothes, had already been placed downstairs inside of the shared first floor bedroom. After awakening, JB went downstairs, entered that bedroom where the victim was sleeping at the time, retrieved his clothes, and got dressed in a nearby bathroom. After dressing, JB sat on the couch with JH and watched television. AH was still asleep. JB recalled that while he and JH were watching television, he heard the victim click her cell phone either open or shut, which he presumed was her checking the time. Immediately thereafter, the victim called out to them that they needed to leave or they would be late for the bus. JB and JH left the house 1 or 2 minutes later, which JB estimated was around the time of 8:13 or 8:14 a.m. Since both children normally caught the bus that transported them to Mohawk Elementary School around 8:12 every morning. As JB exited the house, he noticed a large black truck parked by the garage. The driver of the school bus, which arrived to pick up the children, noted that when he first saw JB and JH, they had made it a third of the way down the driveway and were walking toward the road when JB a little bit ahead of JH. Once the children saw the school bus, however, the driver recalled that they began to run down the driveway toward the bus, with JB outpacing JH by about 10 yards during the run. As they ran toward the bus, the driver did not notice anything unusual in the way the children were acting, and at no time while he was watching them did he observe them leave the driveway or throw anything. Once the children got to the bus, they took their respective assigned seats as per their normal routine. The bus driver recalled observing nothing out of the ordinary about the children's behavior after they had gotten on the bus and during the time they were being transported to school. Approximately 45 minutes after the children got on the school bus, shortly after 9 a.m., a 6-person work crew from a tree service company arrived at the premises to finish collecting firewood that they had cut and collected the previous day from the wooded area located in the front of the house. The crew came in 3 trucks. With the lead truck being driven by the owner of the business, Gary Cable, entering the driveway first. Cable and his workers parked their trucks between the front of the house and the wood line, which was also in the front of the house, but closer to the road. Cable and his crew remained in that area all day. Cable remembered that there was a light coating of snow at the time on the ground, which he estimated was approximately 1/8 to 1/4 inch deep. Cable did not recall seeing any tire tracks on the driveway upon his arrival, although he did note that the center of the driveway was humped up when he pulled in. Cable and his crew began working, after which one of his workers came to him and reported seeing the screen door to one of the entrances to the house standing open. Cable told the worker that he would keep an eye on it. Approximately 10 minutes later, Cable noticed the door open again and observed a little girl, A.H., crying. Whereupon, Cable went up to the porch to see what was the matter. A.H. told Cable that her mother was dead. Cable called 911 and sent one of his workers, Gary, to the end of the driveway to flag down the state police officers who had been dispatched. Cable, without entering the house, attempted to console A.H. by speaking to her through the door, and Cable instructed her to go to get a blanket from the couch and come over to the door so he could talk to her and keep her calm. While waiting for the police to arrive, Gary called Cable on his cell phone and informed him that there were footprints in the driveway. It was at this point that Cable observed two sets of small footprints in the center of the driveway between where the tire tracks run on either side of the driveway. Cable estimated this was approximately 45 minutes after he arrived, around 9:45 a.m. The first state police troopers, Troopers Harry Gustafson and Corporal Jeremy Bowser, arrived on the scene at about 10:13 a.m. Trooper Gustafson encountered A.H., who was crying at the front door. He picked her up and then took her into the residence and sat her on the couch to watch television. Upon entering the residence through the front door, he immediately saw the body of the victim lying on her left side on the bed in the bedroom with a very large pool of blood by her head and upper shoulders and soaking the sheet beneath. Troopers Gustafson and Bowser engaged in emergency ventilation measures until paramedics arrived. During the performance of these resuscitative efforts, the school nurse called the victim's cell phone, requesting to speak with her. Trooper Gustafson answered the phone, identified himself, and talked to the nurse, who indicated that JB was in her office because he was not feeling well, and that he was requesting to come home for the day. Trooper Gustafson asked the nurse to babysit JB until they could make arrangements to have someone pick him up. The paramedics arrived at around 10:40 a.m. and began to examine the victim. During the examination, one of the paramedics noted a gunshot wound to the back of the head. The paramedics could not detect any signs of life from the victim nor a fetal heartbeat. At this point, other crime scene investigators from the Pennsylvania State Police and the Lawrence County Coroner's Office were sent to the scene, after which the victim and her unborn fetus were pronounced dead. In a short period of time thereafter, state police investigators confirmed that CB was at work that morning, as he claimed, and after a gunshot residue test of his hands was negative, he was quickly eliminated as a suspect. One of the state police officers who arrived at the home was Trooper Janice Wilson, who, upon arrival, spoke briefly with A.H. Because A.H. was in a state of shock, she could not provide coherent answers to Trooper Wilson's questions. Trooper Wilson next went to the Mohawk Elementary School to interview J.H. and J.B. Upon arrival at the school, shortly after noon, Trooper Wilson asked to speak to J.B., but was informed he was sleeping in the nurse's office because he had a stomach ache. Trooper Wilson then spoke with J.H., who initially was distraught because she thought she was in trouble. However, she calmed down after the school guidance counselor informed her she was not. Trooper Wilson interviewed J.H. for about 10 minutes, but recalled that she really didn't have much to offer about what had happened that morning. J.H. did not testify at the adjunction hearing. J.B. was then awakened in the nurse's office and brought by his guidance counselor to be interviewed by Trooper Wilson in a nearby conference room. Trooper Wilson did not inform J.B. of the death of the victim, but instead asked him who had been present in the morning at the house, and he replied, "It was his mom," referring to the victim, "and his two sisters and himself." He noted that his dad had already left for work, and A.H. was asleep and did not wake up before he and J.H. left for school. Trooper Wilson next asked J.B. if he had seen anyone else around or any vehicles there that day. J.B. replied that his mom's green van was there, which she used to drive A.H. to school, and also that he saw a large black pickup truck parked by the garage. Trooper Wilson pressed J.B. for details about the truck, since she believed that possibly it could have belonged to the individual who had killed the victim. Trooper Wilson asked J.B. if the truck was running, and he stated that he didn't know. Trooper Wilson inquired if J.B. saw anyone around, and she recalled that he replied no. J.B. remarked that the truck was the same kind that he would usually see when the owner of the farm and another man would be in when they came to feed the cows. Trooper Wilson further queried J.B. about what he had done that morning. He recounted, as detailed above, his actions of retrieving his clothes, getting dressed, and going with J.H. to the bus after the victims told him to hurry up, and then his first observation of the black truck upon exiting the home. The interview concluded at that point. It is noted that none of the trooper's interviews were recorded, and her testimony regarding the interviews she conducted was based on two reports prepared 6 days and 13 days after the interviews, respectively. Meanwhile, during the late morning and early afternoon hours, the state police began searching for Adam Harvey, the ex-boyfriend of the victim, because he had a history of making threats of violence against her. At this time, the victim, as well as her parents, sister, and brother-in-law, had a permanent protection from abuse order against Harvey, stemming from an incident that occurred in February 2008. During this incident, Harvey, then living in North Carolina, had called the victim's mother and threatened to take her whole family out. Harvey was also the owner of a black Ford F-150 pickup truck. Harvey had returned from North Carolina in late October 2008 and had, within the previous 2 weeks, received paternity test results showing that A.H. was not his biological daughter. Also, at some point during the preceding evening of February 19, 2009, Harvey confronted the victim's parents in a nightclub where he had gone to pick up food, resulting in his ejection from the club. Trooper Dominic Camona was dispatched by his supervisor to find Harvey, who was staying with a family that State Trooper Camona knew, the Klingensmiths, in the city of Newcastle. When Trooper Camona arrived at the Klingensmith residence, he was informed by Thomas Klingensmith that Harvey was residing at the address in Union Township, Lawrence County, and that Klingensmith would show him the address. Klingensmith got into State Trooper Camona's car, which proceeded along State Street, the main thoroughfare in Union Township. As the state police cruiser approached the intersection of State Street and Miller Avenue at around 1:20 p.m. in the afternoon, Klingensmith saw Harvey's black truck at the intersection and pointed it out to State Trooper Camona. Trooper Camona parked the police car and walked over to the truck. He asked Harvey to accompany him to the state police barracks to talk with him, and Harvey agreed. Trooper Camona noted that the intersection was located approximately two city blocks from the home of Harvey's parents, where Harvey was staying. Trooper Camona observed that Harvey's truck had a light coating of snow on the hood and roof, and that it was dirty, as if it had been driven. Harvey was taken to the state police barracks and interviewed at around 2:23 p.m. Harvey provided an alibi, stating that he had been home in the basement of his parents' house since around 10 p.m. in the previous evening, and that the only way out of the house was through the upstairs floor where his dad was. Harvey's hands were tested at the time by investigators for the presence of gunshot residue, but none was detected. Based on his proffered alibi and the presence of snow on the truck, which, in the investigators' opinion, suggested that it could not have come off while driving to Wampum, a distance Trooper Camona estimated to be 8 to 10 miles, and then back to his home without coming off, Harvey was excluded as a suspect. Also during the afternoon of February 20th, Corporal Andrew Pinnell of the Pennsylvania State Police conducted a visual inspection of the inside of the house. The house that Corporal Pinnell was inspecting was that of the house of CB and the victim. Corporal Pinnell observed that all the doors to the house were unlocked, and also the front door had blood on its frame. Although the blood was sent for forensic testing, no further information was provided at the hearing regarding its origin. Corporal Pinnell, while walking through the first floor of the house, noticed a blue blanket on the floor near the front of the door, and he seized it because it had a hole in it, which he believed could have been indicative of a gunshot blast. The blanket was subsequently subjected to microscopic examination and chemical testing, and no gunshot residue, blood, or any other tissue was found on it. Upon entering the first floor bedroom where the victim's body was found, Corporal Pinnell noted that the television, which sat on top of the armoire, located in the right-hand side of the room, was turned on. Observing that the doors to the armoire were closed, he opened them. Inside the armoire, he saw a locked gun safe on the bottom shelf, which was later determined to contain two handguns and ammunition. On the top shelf, the corporal saw a work helmet and two boxes of shotgun shells, one open and one closed. The open box contained 16 unfired Federal Premium brand 20-gauge shotgun shells. Corporal Pinnell, accompanied by Sergeant Marlinsky, also of the Pennsylvania State Police, then proceeded to examine the second floor of the house. Upon entering the front bedroom to the right of the stairwell, JB's bedroom, both troopers noted that the presence of six long guns, partially covered by an orange blanket, which was observed from the entrance to the bedroom, were standing in the left-hand side corner of the room nearest the door between the dresser and the wall. The butt of one of the guns, a 30-30 rifle, was protruding the furthest into the room as it leaned against the wall. To its immediate right was a muzzleloader, and leaning directly against that weapon on the right-hand side was a 20-gauge shotgun, a Harrington and Richardson youth model. Both of these guns, like the other four in the group, were found standing upright against the back of the bedroom wall. Corporal Pinnell began to remove individual guns from the group, one at a time, and hand them to Sergeant Marlinsky for him to examine and determine if they were loaded. The first gun removed by Corporal Pinnell was a flintlock rifle, which Sergeant Marlinsky examined and noted nothing unusual about it. The second weapon Corporal Pinnell handed to Sergeant Marlinsky was a 20-gauge shotgun. Sergeant Marlinsky opened the breech of the shotgun and smelled burnt gunpowder in the breech, which he pointed out to Corporal Pinnell, who also smelled the odor. Sergeant Marlinsky also observed gunpowder residue in the breech and in the barrel. Both Corporal Pinnell and Sergeant Marlinsky testified that based on their personal experience with firearms, they believed the shotgun had been freshly or recently fired. However, both acknowledged that they were not offering expert opinions in this regard, and that they could not opine with any degree of scientific certainty exactly when the shotgun had been fired. The 20-gauge shotgun was seized by the troopers and sent for forensic examination. Because of the discovery of the shotgun, at 10 p.m. on the evening of February 20th, Trooper Wilson re-interviewed J.B. at his grandmother's home where he was staying. J.B. had not been informed of the victim's death previously by anyone, so prior to Trooper Wilson speaking with J.B., his father C.B. took J.B. aside and told him something bad had happened and the victim isn't with us anymore. She's in heaven. Upon hearing this, J.B. became emotional and started crying. Once he had calmed down, Trooper Wilson, along with another trooper, began to question J.B. with his father observing. Trooper Wilson described his demeanor as low-key, and that he was not nervous, excited, or fidgety. Trooper Wilson asked J.B. for more details about the black truck and when he had first seen it. J.B. recalled that when he first saw the truck as he exited the house, when he reached in his pocket to see if he had any ice cream money for school, and in the process dislodged a mass of fuzz from his pocket, which fell into the ground. When he bent over to pick it up, it was then he noticed the truck parked by the garage. Trooper Wilson asked J.B. if J.H. had seen the truck, and he replied that he had mentioned it to her, but she didn't respond, and he believed she was, at that point, too far ahead of him to hear him. J.B. also mentioned to Trooper Wilson that while he was out that afternoon in the vehicle driven by one of his relatives, he observed a white S10 truck, which he said to his relative resembled the truck that was at the farm, except he stated that the truck at the farm was black and larger than the S10. J.B. also informed Trooper Wilson that he had seen a person in a white hat ducking over inside the truck he observed at the farm. Trooper Wilson inquired of J.B. why he had not mentioned that when she first talked to him that morning, and he explained that when he first glanced at the truck, he didn't see anybody. J.B. also recounted his observation that the lights were on inside of the truck, and when Trooper Wilson stated that he did not tell her that during the first interview, J.B., after hesitating, then described the lights as being sort of half on. Trooper Wilson next asked J.B. if he had any guns, and he informed her that he had a 30-30 rifle. Trooper Wilson questioned J.B. as to whether he had a shotgun, and he replied yes. She inquired whether he knew what gauge it was, and he stated that it was a 20-gauge, and further related that he only shot the gun outside, and also that if he shot it with his dad last month. Trooper Wilson asked J.B. if he had fired the gun that morning, and he answered no. The interview ended at that point. At 3:30 a.m. on the morning of February 21, 2009, state police arrested J.B. at his grandmother's residence and charged him with the murder of the victim and her unborn fetus. No gunshot residue testing of J.B.'s hands was ever performed. When J.B. was arrested, he was wearing a blue polo shirt, blue jeans, and a brown jacket and tennis shoes. These were the same clothes J.B. had on when he was interviewed by Trooper Wilson at the school at noon on February 20th. Later during the morning of February 21st, after sunrise, a team of state police officers searched the exterior grounds in the immediate vicinity of J.B.'s residence and along its driveway. Sergeant Daniel Brooks and the company of several other police officers began walking outward from the porch and down the driveway toward the road. Just outside of the residence, adjacent to the porch area, they found a very rusty, spent shotgun shell. As the officers walked further down the driveway in the direction of the road, they discovered a second spent shell. This shell, a Federal No. 6 brand 20-gauge, was found approximately 100 feet from the house
on the left-hand side of the driveway at the beginning of the fence line that ran the entire length of the left side of the driveway. The spent shell was located near the base of the wire fence, a few feet from the middle of the driveway, and it was lying underneath the leaves, which were frozen and covered by ice and snow. When asked by the prosecutor at the hearing to describe the condition of the shell, on a sliding scale ranging from pristine to the other spectrum being rusted and broken up, Sergeant Brooks characterized the shell as pristine, and he agreed with the prosecutor that it was not weathered. Further along the driveway near the road, and embedded in the dirt of the driveway itself, the searching officers found a third spent shell, which, like the shell found near the house, was very rusty, and it was also physically crushed into the surface of the driveway. In Sergeant Brooks' view, both rusty shells had been there for quite some time. However, Sergeant Brooks also opined that there was no way to estimate exactly how long any of the three shells had been lying outside. These three spent shells were the only ones found during the trooper search of the property, and after being photographed in their original positions, they were collected as evidence. At the hearing, the Commonwealth presented the testimony of Dr. James Smith, a forensic pathologist, as to the nature of the victim's gunshot wound. Dr. Smith noted that he determined that the victim sustained a single gunshot wound to the back of her neck, which, because of the presence of gunshot pellets in and around the wound, he opined was inflicted by a shotgun. Dr. Smith described the wound as being in the shape of a large oval or ellipse and slanted. Due to the trajectory of the wound, proceeding slightly from the back of the victim's body to the front and upward, Dr. Smith believed it had been inflicted as the victim was lying on her left side on the bed. Dr. Smith further noted that hot gas from the shotgun blast entered the wound through the skin and muscle of the victim's neck and caused the skin to bulge out and rupture near the point of entry. This phenomenon is known as blowback, formed a track or laceration to the skin. To Dr. Smith, the nature of this type of damage indicated that the gas from the shotgun blast was mostly contained within the entry wound and did not have time to dissipate. This factor, coupled with the presence of powder in the wound and soot around the surface of the skin near the point at which the pellets entered the skin, caused him to conclude that the shotgun was very, very close to, or maybe even touching, the back of the neck when it was fired. Although he could not give a precise distance, he estimated the shot was fired from a distance of closer than 2 inches from the victim's neck, and that the barrel of the gun was in close contact with her skin at the time. Dr. Smith found that as the pellets entered the soft tissues of the neck, a small portion of the pellets discharged a piece of the bone from the rear region of the victim's skull near its base, and then entered the interior of her cranial cavity. In his estimation, these pellets caused damage to the centers of the victim's brain, which controlled her nervous functions, thereby causing the death of both the victim and, because of the cessation of the victim's blood circulation, her unborn fetus. Dr. Smith noted, however, that the vast majority of the pellets he observed had rebounded back downward and traveled back in the direction from which they had entered, resulting in them becoming lodged in the back of the victim's neck. Regarding the question of whether the blowback which occurred near the entry wound could have caused blood and other tissue material to travel backwards along the track of the pellets and enter the barrel of the shotgun, Dr. Smith opined that generally, blowback is more common whenever hot gas from a gunshot wound penetrates beneath the skin and encounters bones, which does not yield. Dr. Smith acknowledged that the shot which entered the victim's wound impacted the bones of her skull. Dr. Smith agreed that it was therefore possible that this impact could have caused tissue and blood to have been propelled back through the channel created by the shot and into the barrel of the gun. However, Dr. Smith believed that the angle of the gun at the time the wound was made minimized the amount of blowback, and thus he opined that one would not expect to find as much blood or tissue as one if the barrel was held at a 90-degree angle thereto. Also testifying at the hearing on behalf of the Commonwealth was a certified toolmark and firearm examiner, Trooper Paul Burlingame of the Pennsylvania State Police. Trooper Burlingame examined the 28 shotgun shell seized from JB's residence. After test firing the shotgun and subjecting it to a shock and drop test, he determined that the weapon was not malfunctioning. Trooper Burlingame related that he also compared the 27 shotgun pellets and pieces of wadding recovered from the body of the victim with the pellets from one of the unspent 20-gauge shotgun Federal No. 6 brand shotgun shells found in the armoire of the victim's bedroom. Trooper Burlingame noted that the pellets and wadding discharged from smooth-bore shotguns like the 20-gauge recovered from JB's bedroom do not have any marks on them which would make them generally usable for conducting an individual examination. Trooper Burlingame, therefore, could not perform an individual examination of the pellets recovered from the victim and the pellets in the unfired 20-gauge shells taken from the armoire. He did note, though, that the 27 shotgun pellets recovered from the victim were consistent in size, shape, weight, material, and construction with the pellets and the unfired shells, and also that the pieces of wadding taken from the body of the victim were consistent with the type of wadding and the unfired 20-gauge shotgun shells. Trooper Burlingame also testified that markings created by the manufacturing process, which were found on the discharged shotgun shell recovered from along the fence line to the driveway, were the same as the markings on the unfired 20-gauge shells in the armoire. This led to his conclusion that the discharged shell had been fired from the 20-gauge shotgun taken from JB's room. It does not appear from the record that Trooper Burlingame conducted any comparative analysis of the shot recovered from the victim and the shot contained with the unspent shells, but only a comparison of their exterior characteristics. Additionally, Elena Sumple, the manager of the Forensic Science Department of R.J. Lee Laboratory, a materials testing laboratory, testified at the hearing regarding the results of her testing of the shirt and pants J.B. was wearing at the time of his arrest for the presence of gunshot residue. She explained that whenever a firearm is discharged, the firing pin impacts with the primer cap of the ammunition loaded in the firearm, which causes the chemical elements therein, lead, barium, to ignite, and this force of ignition propels the bullet or projectile in the ammunition out of the front of the muzzle of the gun. According to her, the rapid ignition of these elements after the impact of firing pin with a primer cap causes them to vaporize and form a plume or cloud around the firearm. Eventually, the airborne particles in the cloud coalesce and land on areas immediately surrounding the firearm, such as the shooter's hands and clothes. She noted that whenever a particle is found with the elements fused together, it can be said with scientific certainty that the particle is gunshot residue produced from the discharge of a firearm. She described how she dabbed both sides of the front of JB's shirt and the front of his jeans with double-sided sticky tape and then examined the particles lifted by the tape under a scanning electron microscope. Her examination revealed one particle of gunshot residue on the right side of JB's shirt and one particle of gunshot residue on the left leg of his jeans. She could not pinpoint which specific area of each article of the clothing that had individual particles that were found. She also opined that the particles could have gotten onto the clothing in one of three separate ways. The person could have discharged a firearm, or been in close proximity to somebody else who discharged a firearm, or they came in contact with something that had gunshot residue on it. She further related that such particles can have an enduring presence on articles of clothing, noting, "If I discharge a firearm and took my clothes off, put them in the corner of my room, and they were undisturbed for a month, 2 months later, a year, and then tested, those clothes, you would still find gunshot residue on them." By contrast, she explained that a person who discharged a firearm and then went about his or her daily activities would have any gunshot residue on his or her hands removed by those activities. She additionally related, as a rule of thumb, that she would expect to see more particles of gunshot residue deposited on someone who had fired a gun inside of a house, where there is no airflow, than someone who fired a gun outside, where the wind could affect the disposition of the particles. Corporal Jeffrey Martin of the Pennsylvania State Police testified at the hearing regarding the results of other forensic tests performed on JB's clothing, the spent shotgun shell found along the fence on the left-hand side of the property surrounding JB's home, and the 20-gauge shotgun taken from the residence. Corporal Martin testified that JB's jacket, shirt, jeans, and sneakers seized that morning of his arrest were all tested for the presence of blood stains and that no such stains were found. No fingerprints or DNA material were found on the spent shotgun shells. Forensic examination of the shotgun itself revealed no latent fingerprints on the weapon and no blood was detected in the interior of the shotgun barrel or the exterior of the barrel or on the frame of the shotgun. CB testified at the hearing that he, the victim, JB, and her daughters all had a close relationship, and that JB's relationship with the victim was just as normal as it was between her and her own daughter. With respect to the use of firearms on the property, CB related that he would quite frequently shoot guns in the area of the property located in the front of the house near where the work crew parked the morning of February 20th. CB also described his and JB's participation in a turkey shoot at the indoor shooting range on Saturday, February 14, 2012, less than a week before the 20-gauge shotgun was seized. CB recalled that JB used the 20-gauge shotgun and the turkey shoot, and that he loaded and unloaded the shotgun for JB each time it was fired. CB also recounted that because it was cold winter evening and the shoot took place in a large garage-like structure, JB was wearing a winter coat during the entirety of the shoot, which was the same coat he was wearing the day of his arrest. CB further testified that he and the victim chose to have an unlisted phone number to their house in order to ensure that Adam Harvey could not contact them. CB related that he listened to 10 to 12 voicemails Harvey had left on the victim's cell phone, in which Harvey threatened the victim and her family, and that the victim feared Harvey. CB had no personal knowledge of whether Harvey knew where he and the victim lived. Adam Harvey testified at the hearing as well. He denied making threatening phone calls to the victim and denied the arraignments in the victim's PFA petition, which led to the entry of the PFA order against him. Harvey also stated that he was not upset about the blood test results, which showed that he was not the father of A.H. Harvey admitted seeing the victim's parents on the evening of February 19, 2009, as he was walking out of the nightclub while picking up an order of chicken wings, and that he was told to leave. Harvey claimed that he went home thereafter to his parents' house, where he was living in the basement, which was accessible through the side door on the upstairs floor. He denied going out at all on the night of February 20th, and he stated he did not leave his parents' home until somewhere around 9 a.m. the next morning to return an automotive part to the store. Harvey disavowed knowing where the victim was living, although he acknowledged having told the state police that people had previously informed him that she was living somewhere in Wampum.
I think, sadly, the police got it wrong, and that Kinsey's killer is still out there. However, I understand that Kinsey's immediate family disagree. They truly believe that Jordan is getting away with murder, and he is a monster, even as a child that killed their daughter. Chris is still interested in having the police reopen the case and find out who killed Kinsey, but her family believes they got it right the first time. So depending on what you believe, either a murderer was free and got away with killing someone, or a killer is still out there. So with that, I will end this episode. And thank you all for listening, and I'll talk to you all next time.